I want to begin with a confession. I found this a really challenging passage this week. I didn't really get it for ages. I was scratching my head just wondering, what's Luke trying to say here? Why has Luke included the 12-year-old Jesus? You know, no other gospel includes this passage. What on earth is Luke doing? What is he trying to say? It took me a while, and I found out that I wasn't alone. Loads of other teachers were left puzzled as they asked the same question. J.C. Ryle was clearly among them. It's quite funny. Ryle thought that this passage is mainly about teaching us to be better married couples who read our Bibles and pray together. And I was wondering, is that really what Luke's saying to us here? I love Ryle, but is that the point of this passage? It's not often that I go away unconvinced from J.C. Ryle. It seems even he's a bit perplexed by this account. What's Luke trying to tell us? But eventually it dawned on me just to stop and pause and to ask the question, well, what have we learned so far in Luke's story? If this is the grand climax of his opening account, what's Luke climaxing? What do we know so far? What's the big takeaway? I wonder how you would answer that. What's been the big takeaway so far? I think it's this. Luke's been insisting upon one thing and one thing alone from the get-go. The God of Israel has come to visit his people. The God who's always existed has clothed himself with humanity. Let's not lose the wonder of that. St. Augustine said, without ceasing to be what he eternally was, he became what he eternally was not. Without ceasing to be what he eternally was, he became what he eternally was not. That's what Luke's been letting rip since day one. Remember that the angel visits Mary. Do you remember what the angel said? Your child will be the son of the Most High God. In other words, this kid you're about to give birth to, yeah, it's God. And now Luke draws our attention to what that looks like, you know, because there's a whole lot of questions about that. Jesus is God and man. Well, Luke, can you tell us what you're on about? And Luke says, yes. Come and take a look at a scene when Jesus was just a boy. This is what the God-man looks like at 12 years of age. And so Luke gives us the only account of Jesus' childhood. Many people wonder what Jesus did in between the ages of 2 and 30. We're simply not told. There's no point in speculating. But we are given a glimpse here in Luke's gospel. And I want us just to notice how cleverly constructed it is. Remember, Luke's ordered his account. He hasn't just scribbled down aimlessly. It's an ordered gospel. He told us that in chapter 1. Luke knows how to put stories together. Just notice the bookends of this passage. Verse 40, the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Verse 52, Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. It's bookended with this very human Jesus. And in the middle, we have a story of Jesus in the temple. And really, it's the climax of the first two chapters. We've literally been building up to this moment. And so we're going to do something a little different today. We're just going to go through the story. We're going to enjoy it. It's packed with tension. And then we're just going to land hard on verse 49. That's what we're going to do. And if you take anything away from this passage, I want us to go away with a deep sense of wonder at the beautiful and matchless life that Jesus lived on our behalf. That's what I want us going away with. A deep sense of wonder at the beautiful and matchless life that Jesus lived on our behalf. So here we go, verse 41. Take a look, verse 41. Now Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. Jesus and his family went to Jerusalem every year. Only Joseph was required to go, but they all took the trip. The Passover was one of the three major festivals in the religious calendar. You know, it's marked in the diary. You don't miss this day. And it would have been a thrilling experience for a 12-year-old boy. Maybe you can picture the scene. The streets are crammed with 200,000 pilgrims. 100,000 sheep for sacrifices. Think of all of the sights and the sounds. At age 12, Jesus would have had the run of the city. He would have feasted with friends, entered the temple to pray and to sing. And on the night of the Passover, he would have sat on the edge of his seat as his father prepared the sacrificial lamb and recounted the story of salvation. You see, Joseph would have reminded Jesus how God rescued his people from slavery and delivered them from the iron grip of Egypt. You can maybe imagine his eyes wide open as Jesus hears about the lamb slain and the blood brushed up against the door. See, that way death passed over Israel. Passover. God passed over because of the blood. It was an exciting time, this. And if you're a Jew, you don't miss the Passover celebration. It's probably the highlight of the year. But it didn't last long. Eventually, the Passover comes to a close, and it's time for them to go home. And it's here that we have the famous left behind incident. I wonder if you can sense the panic. Have a look at verse 43. It says, "And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be in the group, they went on a day's journey. But then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances, and when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him." So Mary and Joseph, they're on their way back home. The festivities are over for another year. They're traveling with a group of people. Zechariah and Elizabeth's probably among them. You know, you don't travel as individual families. You go in large communities. They were part of a spiritual family. That's just what you did back then. And so they're heading back to Nazareth. It was custom for the women to set off first because they took longer. I'm going to restrain myself from making a comment on that. And then the men would carry on behind them. And as they started out, Mary would have said, well, Jesus isn't with us. But since he's training and preparing for adulthood, he's behind with the men at the back somewhere. And at the back, Joseph would have been strolling behind and thinking, well, Jesus isn't here. But he's with Mary and the children. That makes sense for him to be there. As they travel a day's journey, verse 44, thinking that he's with the group. Well, the day comes to an end. The sun's beginning to set. And Joseph finally catches up with Mary. And he asks, well, is Jesus with you? No. I thought he was with you. No, he's not with me. Where is he? And so they begin to raise their voices around the camp. I wonder if you can maybe hear their voices. Jesus, 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 son. Has anyone seen him? And then that sick feeling begins. People say, no, we haven't seen him all day. And so they camp that night. They set off the next day. They head back to Jerusalem. They look everywhere for their child. And you know, the fear for Mary and Joseph is, well, what's happened to him? You can imagine it, can't you? Losing a child is parents' worst nightmare. Just recently in Australia, a 4-year-old girl, Cleo, was abducted from her family's camping tent. It was all over the news. You might have seen it. As each day came to a close, there was no sign of her. 3 days, nothing. 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, nothing. And there was a sickening feeling. Yeah, praise God, she was found. That was a miracle, and it made the front page all over the world. But there's something deeply sickening about a young child that's been lost. And so just think of how Mary and Joseph are feeling. They're not aliens. They're people like us. They're just like us. There's a reason for them to fear as well. You know, just like the Cleo situation, little children were abducted in the ancient world. There were millions of slaves in Jesus' day. It wasn't uncommon for children to be kidnapped, sold into slavery. That was just the cruel nature of the ancient world. And a 12-year-old boy, well, he is the perfect target. He's got his whole life ahead of him. So he's the perfect candidate for slavery. Notice verse 46. This went on for 3 days. 3 days, imagine that. 3 days of sickening worry. What on earth has happened? Verse 46. After 3 days, they found Jesus in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Okay, so we can breathe a sigh of relief. It appears Jesus is safe and sound. And what we find out is that Jesus, actually, he wasn't left behind. This was a self-conscious decision. We saw that in verse 43. The boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. He wasn't kidnapped. No, he chose to stay. Here he is in the temple asking questions. Remember, the temple is the focal point of God's covenant blessing. It's the place to be. It's here that God meets with his people. Jesus wanted to be with God. And it's here that Mary and Joseph find him. And they peer into the temple and they see their son engaging with the teachers of the law. It's like Jesus is at Bible college. He's having a seminar with the learned theologians. But as the dialogue goes back and forth, it becomes clear that there is something unusual about this boy. It dawns on us that Jesus isn't just a great listener. Now, he's the center of attention in this whole thing. Look at verse 47. All who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. Jesus wasn't just asking questions, he was teaching. That was unheard of in the day. 12-year-old boys don't teach rabbis. Rabbis teach 12-year-old boys. But Jesus is surpassing the religious elites of the day, even at age 12. And the answers that Jesus gives are so perceptive that everyone's just amazed at his wisdom. Notice, they want to hear more. But I want us to consider this question. How is that possible? How is it that Jesus teaches with such authority just at 12 years of age? I know how we're tempted to answer that. Jesus is God. There you go, case closed. Jesus is God. God knows everything. That's what's going on here. That's how we're tempted, I think, to answer that question. But I want to just press the familiar reset button on that answer. It's true, of course. Jesus is God, fully God as God is God. But if we follow that answer to its logical conclusion, we end up saying that Jesus just cruised along in life by his divinity, and he knows nothing of what it means to be a human who grows and learns. See, that's the logical conclusion. If we follow that logically, we end up saying, Jesus, he just relied on his divinity, he cruised along by his divinity, and he knows nothing of what it means to be a human. Friends, that's a problem. See, if that's true, Jesus can't be my Savior. We just can't think like that. Luke's Gospel doesn't give us room for that answer. You see, Jesus, in his humanity, had a passion for the Bible. He believed its words. He trusted in its promises. He sought to apply its wisdom to his life. Jesus was living in daily dependence upon the words of his Father. And he could teach it with ease and simplicity. Not because he's God, but because he's truly human. He studied the Bible by the Spirit, as a human like us. And verse 52 says, verse 40 says, he grew in wisdom, in learning, and in favor with gods and men. Well, all of this took Joseph and Mary by surprise. Verse 48 it says, and when his parents saw him, they were astonished. The word is knocked out. They were just knocked back completely by what they're seeing. You know, what's going on? I wonder if this is mixed with a sense of relief knowing that he's safe. I'm sure it would be. But notice it didn't take Mary long to snap into mother mode. And understandably, she says to Jesus, take a look, son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. It's totally understandable. I think we'd all do the same if we were in Mary's shoes, let's be honest. And it comes from a mixed heart, doesn't it? A mixed heart of motherly love, but also a fear of what could go wrong. It's been a distressing 3 days. How could Jesus do this to them? He's put his parents through living torments. How could you do this to us? She asks. Well, I wonder if you've noticed, but the tension's been building and building and building. We've been feeling the pressure rise in the passage, and since verse 41, we've had the sense that something big is about to happen. And now, finally, in verse 49, we get the grand climax. And now, I don't want to sort of bore us with technicalities here, but the word saying or statement has been Luke's way of highlighting the important stuff all the way through so far. In verse 50, they don't understand the saying. Verse 51, it's Mary literally treasured up this saying in her heart. And so Luke's wanting us to zoom in on this particular saying of Jesus. It's what he wants us to focus on. The first recorded words of Jesus in the Gospel. Here we go, verse 49. Jesus said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" Now there's a debate about the wording here. You may have a footnote in your Bible. That was just read from the ESV. The New King James has Jesus saying, "My Father's business." At the end of the day, I don't think it matters. It's quite clearly both. Jesus is in his Father's house. Why? Because he's going about his Father's business. So the point is the same. Jesus submits himself to the will of his Father. But I don't want us to get sidetracked and to miss just the wonder of what Jesus is saying. Look at what he says again. "My Father's house." It's the grand climax we've been building up to. It's a radical statement of identity. No Jew would ever say what Jesus has just said. It would never be uttered from their lips. Listen to these words from David Gooding. He says, "The teachers of the law knew the Old Testament inside out. In all the Old Testament, not even Moses who built the tabernacle, not David who longed to build the temple, not Solomon who actually built it, no king or commoner, not the most exalted among them, had ever referred to the temple as my Father's house. The child was conscious of a relationship with God that none had conceived of, let alone expressed." The child, Jesus, assumes a relationship with God that no one else has had. No one else spoke of God as my Father. No one would have imagined it. The fatherhood of God is present in the Old Testament. That's true. But it's always spoken in the plural. God is our Father. Nowhere did a particular individual say, "God is my Father." But Jesus says it as though it's the most natural thing in the world to say. It's staggering. It's a 12-year-old boy. As you hear, we're taken up into the mystery of the Trinity. We've already pondered the mystery of the Incarnation, the Son taking on flesh to be with us. But here we see a glimpse of the Trinity. As the incarnate Son, Jesus knew God as Father, even as a boy. You see, the Son had always known the Father. Here he is enjoying the relationship with the one that he's known from eternity past. And for the eagle-eyed among us, I wonder if you've noticed that Jesus voices personally what's been proclaimed publicly. Jesus voices personally what's already been proclaimed publicly. We've been told this boy will be called the Son of God. That he'll be the Lord. The angel's already said that. He's made it clear. All of these astonishing claims are now coming from the lips of the 12-year-old boy Jesus himself. Jesus knows who he is. He's the Son of the Father. And his Father was at the temple. See, and this means that when Jesus is at the temple, he's where he's supposed to be. In fact, there's a divine compulsion, isn't there? Didn't you know that I must be in my Father's house? Jesus is surprised that Mary and Joseph were looking for him. Didn't they know he'd be in the temple with his Father? I wonder if Jesus is reminding his parents of the angelic visitations. You were told this. Why are you so surprised? Jesus isn't being a smart aleck here. He's not sinning against his earthly parents. He wasn't disobeying their instructions. He was exactly where they should have expected to find him. That's why Jesus is so startled by Mary's question. They were only his earthly parents. And Mary said, I and your Father were looking for you. But no, Jesus' real Father was God in heaven. This is where Jesus needed to be. All throughout his life, Jesus said, I've come to do the will of my Father. Especially through John's Gospel, we hear it all the time. From day one, Jesus was minding his Father's business. He obeyed his words. He submitted to his will. If ever a child could demand his own way, it's Jesus. Think about that. He's the Son of God. He's God the Son. And here, look at what we read in verse 51. Jesus went with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. Jesus wasn't a rebellious child. While being the eternal Son of God, he submitted to his parents as a child. That just blows my mind. While being the eternal Son of God, he submits to his earthly parents as a child. With all humility, he cheerfully and willingly obeyed Mary and Joseph. Notice at the end of verse 51, we read that Mary treasured up Jesus' saying in her heart. She's still pondering those startling words. No one ever spoke like this. Jesus makes a radical statement of identity. He is the Son of the Father. And so she ponders. You can maybe imagine Dr. Luke at the door of Mary with pen and paper in hand as she recounts this astonishing scene. And Mary says, and I treasured up these things in my heart. They still amaze me today. I didn't get it then, but I'm slowly starting to get it now. And all of this should amaze us too. Luke wants us to join Mary in treasuring the mystery of the Trinity as we gaze at this 12-year-old boy Jesus. This is what he wants us to get. There's a mystery going on here. Luke wants us to marvel, wonder, to treasure. He wants us to ponder these things. He wants us to marvel at the God-man, Jesus Christ. Well, having considered all that, I want us to end with this bookend verse, verse 52. I've gone with verse 52, but it's pretty much the same as verse 40. Take a look at it. We're told, Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature, and in favor with God and man. I think what blows my mind about this verse is that Luke's saying Jesus is just as human as the rest of us. That he grew physically, mentally, and spiritually. He grew physically, mentally, and spiritually. He's the Son of God. And yet while never ceasing to be God, he went from baby to child, to boy, to man, just like the rest of us. It's amazing, isn't it? And so first, Jesus grew physically. Jesus grew in strength, stature, size. He grew as all children grow. There's nothing robotic about him. He learned to crawl and walk. He was toilet trained. He depended on his mother's breast. He grew taller and stronger. He grew up learning to read and write. He learned the skills of a carpenter. When people saw Jesus, they saw a true human. They didn't look at him and think they were staring at an alien. They looked and saw a human being. Second, Jesus grew in wisdom. In other words, he exemplifies really the book of Proverbs. If you were to look at the portrait of the wise man in Proverbs, you would see Jesus' picture there. Jesus spoke wise words. He had wise hopes and desires. He conducted himself with wise deeds. He learned to work hard, speak kindly. He lived in sexual purity. He trusted God in everything. He feared God. Remember, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There's never been a wiser man than Jesus Christ. Never. Never will be. Thirdly, he grew spiritually. Notice it says he grew in favor with God and people. In other words, Jesus learned what it was to grow from an obedient child to an obedient man. And God the Father smiled on this boy as he grew. And for the moment, many smiled with him. But there was something deeply attractive about him. Just imagine parenting Jesus. I don't know if you ever wondered that, what it would have been like to parent Jesus. Never having to discipline him for sin. Never hearing him complain at the dinner table. Oh, it's marvelous. Never breaking up a fight. He never just goes and fights his brothers. It would have been wonderful parenting Jesus. In every respect, Jesus demonstrates a perfect human life. Here is humanity as we were meant to be. The perfect image and likeness of God. But here's what we must leave with. I want us to consider how important it is that Jesus grew like this. See, at no point, not for one second of his life, did Jesus ever desire to do anything other than the perfect will of his Father. You know, consider the temptations that Jesus faced. He didn't cave once. And that matters immensely. For if Jesus even for one instant turned away in rebellion, yearned for some ungodly desire, committed just one thought of unchastity, coveted something that didn't belong to him, it's all over. To be the sacrifice that paid for sins, he had to be flawless. Had to be. This should mesmerize us. Especially if, like me, you know the relentless nature of temptation. To never give in once. Jesus would have faced the most relentless barrage of temptations that any human being has ever faced before. Satan knew how many sins it would take to make Jesus a sinner. The one would do. Satan needed to trip Jesus up just once to bring an end to salvation. And so imagine how relentless his assaults were. Some people think that Jesus' temptations weren't real because he is God. And it's true. Jesus could never sin because he's God. That's true. But that's not why he didn't sin. I'm just going to repeat that because it's a really important distinction. Jesus could never sin because he's God. But that is not why he didn't sin. Jesus didn't sin, not because he's God, but because as a man, he resisted by the power of the Spirit. He didn't rely on his divinity. All the way, Jesus yielded himself by the Spirit. The only way Jesus can identify and help us in our temptation is because he really did face the same battles as a man. And I want us to consider this. Because Jesus never sinned, he fought every temptation, every time until he defeated everyone coming out the other side victorious. I can't even comprehend that. Isn't it clear that so often we give in to sin just to take the pressure off? I wonder if you're like me. It's deeply appealing to give up because it's so hard and tiring to keep fighting. Often we give in because it's easier. Fighting is just hard. So marvel at our sinless Savior. Jesus never once gave in to that delicious longing to end the struggle by yielding to temptation. Rather, he fought and fought and fought and fought every temptation, coming out in victory the other side. Don't we see this in the Garden of Gethsemane? Now, why did Jesus need to pray three times? Why did he drop sweats of blood? Was it not because he had to keep fighting to win? And yet he prays, Father, not my will, but thine be done. There's nothing to do but marvel at our sinless and obedient Savior. This little section in Luke's Gospel is so important. From the beginning of his life to the end, Jesus lived as a man in perfect obedience to his Father, whom he had known from eternity. Never once did he stray. As Jesus contemplated the terrors of the cross, he prayed to his Father that his will would be done, that the Father's will would be done. He submitted himself to the will of God, even if it meant suffering the agony of the cross. And I want us to close with a surprise in verse 52. I think we get that Jesus grew in favor with God. That makes sense. Of course, God would be happy with his life. But people? He grew in favor with people? Isn't that surprising? Obedience isn't particularly attractive in our culture, is it? We think there's something weird about obedient children. We have nicknames for them, don't we? Square, do-gooder, goody-goody two-shoes, teacher's pet, there's a whole host of them. If we see a well-behaved teen, we think they're stifled. They can't live their lives to the full. Obedience sounds so restrictive, it dampens fun and joy. They're killjoys. But notice, Jesus obliterates that. Friends, obedience to God isn't just good, it's the best life to live. The best life to live. See, Jesus' life was the most attractive life that's ever been lived. He was perfectly obedient to his Father from cradle to cross. We always mess up our obedience, don't we? Even when we get it right, we get it wrong. Our obedience often just becomes self-righteousness, superiority. We look down on others, and that's not attractive, is it? People aren't drawn by that. They're repelled. Jesus is the only one who can pull it off. He's the only one who gets it right. And furthermore, this obedient life, Jesus lived for others. In some remarkable sense, Jesus is generous with his obedience. He does his obedience for others. He does it for those who will trust in him. His whole life is lived and given up for us. It's the weak, the disobedient, who receive that obedience. See, as a result of the cross, if I trust in Jesus, God looks at me as if the obedience of Jesus were my own. That's Jesus' mission. That's his Father's business. That's why God the Father sent God the Son. The Father sent the Son on a rescue mission, a mission to live a perfect life of obedience on our behalf and to die in our place. That's what Christmas is all about. And I wonder if you can see the real joy, the real wonder in all of this. The real joy in all of this is because Jesus has the right to call God his Father. He's able to share that with you and with me. Through him, we have the right to become sons and daughters of God. So that individually and together, we can say, my Father, my Father. That's a truth to treasure in our hearts. It's a truth to base our lives upon.